So, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening for those joining our session today. Today's session will be about paying the living wage to workforce across the value chains. What are the solutions in a CS3D and in a CS3D world? We will discuss in more details with our speakers today. My name is Crystal Basile. I work as a business human rights consultant at XAPA. In a little bit, Farid will tell us more about XAPA as well. So I will be the moderator for the session today. But before I introduce the panelists and our discussion, just a few housekeeping rules for today. Please note that you're muted, and please choose the chat function. If you have any questions, we will have a Q&A in the end of the session. Your cameras are automatically switched off for bandwidth, and you're welcome to invite other participants as we go on in the discussion. Please feel free to use social media to reach out to us at xapa.org. And I would like to note that the session is recorded, and it will be later shared on our page, and you could share it with your colleagues as well. So I'm joined today by the speakers, Amy Glassmeyer from. So I don't know if you want to jump the slides, Farid. Here we go. Amy Glassmeyer, founder of the Living Wage Institute, and Farid Badash, CEO of XAPA. They will better introduce themselves and their respective organizations in just a few moments. But before we get to that, just very quickly on why we are having this discussion. So according to the ILO, the International Labour Organization, hundreds of millions of workers are still trapped in working poverty and do not earn enough. Do not earn enough to have a decent standard of living. So living wage and income is an enabling right, spilling over to improve health, education, and living conditions. Workers do not earn enough to meet the basic needs, which is what we will discuss more in this. We will discuss of how we calculate that, what are the challenges. Many even work excessive hours or accept conditions like of forced labor, or even put their children to work at the expense of an education. So the recent wave of inflation has dramatically impacted vulnerable workers. But what is also interesting is that we know that the CSRD today, that is in force in Europe, requires that eligible companies disclose whether direct workforce, as well as workforce in the value chain, are operating above the living wage. So it's with this growing regulatory framework that sets the scene of today's discussion, which is what brings us to the Living Wage Institute. And Amy, I will hand over to you to quickly introduce yourself and your organization. Over to you.
Thank you. And it's nice to be here. I'm Amy Glassmeyer. I'm a professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. I am one of the co-creators of the Living Wage Calculator, which was developed in 2003. I am also a co-founder of the Living Wage Institute, which is an organization that assists employers in calculating the cost of living for their employees.
Thank you, Amy. Farid, do you want to tell us a little bit about XAPA?
Sure, so I can introduce myself briefly for our participants as well. My name is Farid Badash. I'm working at XAPA. It's an organization that is headquartered in Paris with offices in London and New York, and operations and programs across multiple geographies, particularly in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. When it comes particularly to the broader, what we call from our perspective, the broader human rights agenda. We work with a good number of multinational companies, multilateral organizations, and financial institutions. And the question of living wage is something I've worked on for 15 years or so. It's a topic that has always been find kind of technical, in my opinion, but also fascinating because there's so many inequalities and so much work in the space where with greater clarity on the concept, where with all too often limited effort from companies and from employers, they can have dramatic impact on the daily life of millions of people and workers, as you pointedly, Christelle. So I'm looking forward to the conversation here today.
Thank you. So I don't know if you want to jump into it already. We can start with the first question. What do you think are the main challenges of working on living wage issues today? Also bringing in both perspective, given that Amy is based in the US and we are based in Europe. So how do we see the same issues, but from different angles? Amy.
Thank you. So I would say that the largest challenges today are ones that relate to measurement. And I say that measurement and awareness. And I say measurement because if you are going to use a calculated value, you need to have good inputs that actually represent the conditions that you think are important in people's lives. In the United States, we happen to have a national statistical system that allows us, for the most part, to collect information in a readily systematic form. And we, I think, are, along with a number of the more economically developed countries, have systems like that. But so data is extremely important. It's a challenge for everybody. There also are different social customs and a whole set of regulations that each individual country occupies in the labor market, which would probably have an influence over what a living wage country by country would look like. And there is also just a paucity of understanding on the part of employers as to what a living wage is and why it's an important component of a corporate strategy.
Thank you, Amy. Farid?
I would just kind of build upon your points, Amy, and maybe talk a little bit more about awareness and add maybe an additional point about scope of application in a way. When it comes to awareness, just maybe with a few visuals that can help support my ideas here, it's our experience, and what we do at XAPA is often to engage with companies and people at human resources and payroll and the like. And in the space, some people feel comfortable whenever there is, and that's not all the time the case, but whenever there is like a minimum wage, people believe that the minimum wage is a decent wage in a way. It's, you know, you abide by the law and you're fine, which is definitely wrong from a pure living wage perspective. Whenever measurement tend to show that all too often minimum wage is definitely not the right threshold or the right way to assess whether people make a decent living out of their wage. There is actually also the question of market wage, which in a way is how much you pay for a given job in a given location. And all too often, human resources people tend to believe that you pay kind of what we call a market wage for that type of job. You should be paid that level of wage, which is not necessarily the right definition neither. So it's this question of awareness is something that I think, in my opinion, should not necessarily be our role to educate professionals in the space, but it's really a big challenge. Just to complement your thoughts. And another one, which I think is actually also related maybe to how the workforce and has changed over the recent decades, maybe a lot of sensitive activities have been outsourced from large corporations, meaning that sometimes companies can work on living wage within the scope of their own workforce. Whereas most of the most sensitive segments of the workforce are outsourced to temporary workers, and also often contracted activities where a lot of hot spots can actually really lie in terms of insufficient access to living wage. In response, because here in this discussion, I'm kind of also providing a perspective with regulations and regulatory initiatives increasingly at stake in the European Union for companies across the globe, the US included, for their workforce in the US. The CSRD is calling for assessment of living wage for workforce and for strategized contracted or supply chain or workers in the value chain. And I think that's a challenge to get back to the question, because too few companies that I can see are actually at the end of the day aware of living wage for their own workforce, although it should become increasingly just like kind of a standard practice. And I think an additional challenge to complete the some of the top challenges that can be at stake in discussion is to expand those type of assessment to sensitive segments that can all too often be contracted or in the value chain. So that would be, I would kind of just maybe expand a little bit some of the challenges, and it's a big topic.
Yeah, thank you. Let's go on to the next question and see what are some of the concrete solutions to these issues. Amy, you mentioned that calculating the living wage was a main issue. You saw what are some of the solutions you developed in the Living Wage Institute to address some of these issues?
So above and beyond the challenges of calculation, I mean, in the United States context, we're very lucky in that we have a statistical mechanism by which we can collect a certain amount of information, and it's been standardized over time. But it's not enough to have a value, and it's not enough to be able to even quote a value to an employer. What they don't have experience with is understanding the co-responsibility that the worker and the employer have in sharing the outcome of human labor. And the living wage tool has the capacity to help employers understand the actual value that's being created and to have a better understanding of why it is that they can be a very active participant in the process of determining what a living wage ought to be. There are a number of issues that arise. For example, in the US context, we have different kinds of wages. We have everything from an hourly wage to a monthly wage to a contract wage. And as a result of all of that variation, you have many different values. An employer could choose many of any one of those values and reward somebody with that or give somebody that in return for the effort that they undertake. But what's important for really the adoption of and the utilization of a living wage is that the employer understands the value to his or herself. And the value is recognizing what does it take for a human being to be an effective employee, which is at the end of the day, the key issue for why somebody is employed and why an employer employs them. And some of the things that we've been able to develop to help carry on that thinking are such things as a benefits adjusted living wage. So some employers might think that they are a part of the wage is the benefit, but in fact, the benefit can actually be less than what the cost of that particular needed good is. And so we've developed a number of different kinds of tools to allow us to have a better communication with employers as they start to think about employee rewards. We also recognize that over time, a lot of things change and that it's important to be able to show what the cost of living has been and how it has changed over time and how the composition of what a living wage is has changed over time. Employers don't have data like that. That's not what they're thinking about. What they're thinking about is making something, getting it out the door, and getting it sold. And so we're able to do that. And I would say the last thing that we're able to do in this world of communicating living wage and its importance is we are able to help an employer understand the relationship between what they do and the productivity that they receive and the way that we incent productivity and the way we reward people for the work that they provide. And so those, I think, are some of the solutions that employers, this language of living wage is not a language that is universal. And as a result, we have to be responsible in describing what it means and what it can do for an employer in accomplishing their task.
Absolutely. I guess we've seen it with one of the clients we worked with. It's important also to have, I guess, especially for multinationals that have presence in different countries, it's important to have a centralized approach to living wage, as you're saying, because across countries, the definition of living wage is still not the same. The payments are different. The standards are different. The cost of living are different. So it's important to have a centralized also approach to what are these important standards and things that need to be trickled down with the living wages. Farid, what about your side of the story? What kind of solutions at XEPA you offer to tackle these issues?
I mean, the first question is the collection of the right data and thresholds. And actually, I must say that having practiced those discussions or those topics for more than a decade, I value significantly and extensively the quality of the work that you are doing, Amy, notably in the US, because the quality of the data and information that is provided is significantly higher than what we have to work with across other geographies. I think it's a good starting point. And we're facing that because what we do, therefore, in response, you know, so this is often some of the clients that are asking us to explore living wage across geographies. So basically we do that across whatever geographies that with exception from a limited number of countries where it's just really, really not possible. Venezuela is a good example. There's just no macroeconomic data that is reliable. That said, we are trying, and it's not necessarily easy to align with employers and human resources with some information where we triangulate with multiple sources of data the best kind of zone of what the living wage might mean in, let's say, Cambodia or Vietnam or wherever. Because in those geographies, the question of the quality of the data is really, really challenging. Therefore, we try to triangulate with as many sources as we can. We include some inflation. We face challenges like the fact that sometimes the data we can find have been dated back in 2 years or something, or they're not granular enough from the geography, but still it's part of our job to try to kind of build best alignment we can on some kind of directional thresholds. So that's one thing we do. Another thing we do then is to kind of help and work closely with employers to collect information across workforce between fixed wages and bonuses and compensations that can align as much as possible with some methodologies. We tend to use the anchor methodology as much as we can to define how best a combination of those fixed and variable that are eligible can enable workers to go above some thresholds. And I think the most interesting aspect of that legwork is the outcome of that, where all too often for too many employers, a fear is to conclude that, long story short, they need to increase wages, meaning that sometimes that this is conflicting with some of what they can expect to remain competitive or whatever across some of the markets, where a reason why they're invested or they have a presence is often the cost of workforce. And in fact, it can definitely be part of the solution, but there are many, many other more creative ways to help workers and human resources to improve the livelihood fundamentally of workers. And that's all about engaging workers, being creative about their actual needs and some of the challenges that they can face. Sometimes it can be about providing access to food or healthcare services or transportation, things that help ultimately to increase basically value or purchasing power that they can have with their budget. So we help on those instances, and I would say that that's often something really in co-creation with companies, because it's very, very complex. All in all, to really understand what's at stake across multiple geographies. So I share all of that with a lot of humility.
Thank you. I guess looking to the future, what do you think the future of living wage will be? We see a rise of, as we were mentioning, rise of regulations. This is in line with the human rights due diligence and the call to sort of map also suppliers and also look into their practices. How do you think this is going? Is and I see there is a good number of companies in the audience. Is regulation really going to bring companies more on board, or are we really, as many of us fear, is going to become very much a compliance-like approach to dealing with it? I mean, we also need to look at the reality of things, and companies need to remain competitive. What do you think, Amy? Where are we going with this?
So I would say that this is a really remarkable time. I've been involved in this for 20 years, and I can say that on a daily basis, the communication of something called a living wage and the importance that it has for individuals and families has never been greater. And it's kind of ironic, because today, also in the United States, we don't hear a word about minimum wage. And so if I put those two things together, I would say that people are recognizing very clearly, and employers in particular are recognizing, that there is a possibility of a different future and a different capability and experience for individuals and families. And you can see it this morning in the news. There was an article from the Esri Corporation, which was showing three different companies that they had helped develop a supply chain tracking system. And it was down to the pallet. And so it's not as if there's just lack of technology that's available. It's really more a lack of education. And I think also employers are in a position where there is an opportunity to learn something about the role that they play in society, which is they provide work and they provide compensation and they provide an integrity and merit. And we see this forming. It may appear in many places to be very slow, but in fact, companies are taking this up on their own. What they don't have is the time to actually figure it all out. And that's why the various organizations that are providing information on living wages and the value of that becomes so important. It is really not a step in the business sense to figure out, well, how much do these people need to make? What is a standard of living that I can support? And I feel that more and more today, there's a recognition that it is possible to measure this. And if it's possible to measure this, then you can account for it. And eventually, what you're going to find are leaders and you're going to find followers. And I think we see that not only in the United States, but in the international realm, as well as even in we've been able to estimate living wage values for places like Mexico City, and it requires a lot of on the ground analysis and observation. But once you get a benchmark, the benchmark can be incremented over time. You can begin to understand how you make changes. And I think we also have the opportunity to learn to facilitate the development of greater capabilities for the individual's life as a worker. So, you know, work today can be very dull, and it can be very dangerous, and it can be very dirty, but it also has an alternative future if we are capable of working and collaborating with an organization that has the information to know what the difference is between good, better, and best. I don't think that this is going to be only a regulatory issue. I think that employers today are trying to get ahead of the curve because they know when you get behind a regulation, it's an inevitable race and you're constantly running. So whereas if you start to establish the standards in your own organization and you actually ask your employees to help you develop the standards in your own organization, you have a much better chance of making this be something that can be a 1, 3, 5 year process than if all of a sudden somebody throws in a piece of legislation into Congress and it gets passed and then you have to implement it in a short period of time without a lot of background. So I'm pretty optimistic. This is not something that is going to go away. I think people are really pushing and they are rightfully articulating what's important to them. And their lives are, in certain cases, actually getting better.
Thank you, Amy. We always need optimism. Ferry, do you share Amy's view of the future?
Partly, yes. I sometimes, with this topic, I have the feeling that a dimension related to ensuring that the workforce is well paid with a good number of benefits coming out of it is something where it's kind of reinventing the wheel from what could have been said about the very same thing 1 century ago. So there is a little bit of that. I would say that if we say that some of the key stakeholders in the discussions are both employers and policymakers, I was part of, in fact, I developed an initiative with OECD called Business for Inclusive Growth that was kicked off at a G7 event in 2019. And at that time, of course, when you look at an agenda for what inclusive growth might include, living wage was definitely part of it. And what surprised me when I did that, and just connecting to the future, but I think it's related, is that several stakeholders, policymakers on the one hand or employers on the other, and of course they were pretty committed, otherwise they would not be part in that type of journey. Although they were still kind of struggling with the concept of if you pay more, basically beyond, let's say, a minimum wage whenever possible, how can you ensure that you really have a return on investment somehow in terms of, and it's kind of I think struggling. So for me, the future is anything first and foremost where trying to build upon Amy's point, anything where this is here to stay, companies are have to struggle to remain ahead of the curve, first to be attractive as employers, second, to anticipate regulation and that type of things. If this can help companies, it's fine. A second aspect I can share is related to the actual direct engagement of workers. I think today, workers are increasingly basically in a position where they want to choose, they want to be understood, they want to be part of the discussion. It's not just like a top-down discussion with an employer asking an employee to which extent whatever benefits or something is adapted to what he, she needs. In that space and related to a broader due diligence agenda, at least some of the future that we are helping to contribute is to enable employers and workers to communicate through an application that I think is pretty timely because it helps employers inform employees about their rights, the benefits that they can access. That's basically the type of application that we're using. As you can see, the employers can disseminate information, and as an employee, you can understand, for example, how to activate an healthcare system without having to pay for it, or you can access canteen for free. A lot of fringe benefits or services that can help basically increase the kind of access to living wage or the purchasing power you have with whatever level of income you have. So this is the type of thing that we do. And because it's an app, it can easily be disseminated beyond employers, for example, and for temporary workers as well. But also, there are ways to kind of collect information from employees themselves in terms of where they're struggling. Is transportation, for example, a major source of concern or a source of cost? And how then, in response, because you collect information from employees, you can aggregate that in this type of dashboard to understand who ultimately has a risk profile among whatever workforce that can be defined, and what are the best kind of levers that can be deployed by companies to respond. And for example, craft a, let's say, a transportation scheme that can really increase attractivity of a facility and help complement basically the total expenses required by an employee to go, for example, or to commute, that type of thing. So that's fundamentally part of the future for me. It's one, anything that can build greater alignment on between policymakers, one, employers, two, and the business case, and two, the type of tools that can, the portfolio of tools, which altogether can ensure that there is a growing, ongoing conversation between employees and employers to first define thresholds, but second, I would say co-create somehow some of the solution that are best fit in view of what employees and contractors and this type of focus really need. So I would, that would be my view on the topic.
Thank you. I invite participants to pop in their questions to Amy and Farid in the chat box, or comments. It doesn't have to be just questions. And Farid, I don't know if you want to share the very quick poll, if you have a minute or so, just a very quick poll for the questions for the webinar. So if we want to conclude before we take a few questions from the participants, so if you want to conclude, what I get from both your point of views is that it's ultimately about bettering the lives of the workers and their families, but what keeps coming back is that there's a business case. It's also beneficial to the company. What I also took away is that it's about an education process. So it's not about just complying with regulation, etc., but it's about the company learning about its own workforce and suppliers, but also learning why living wage is paid, how it's paid, where it's paid, and really understanding the whole process. And in that sense, regulation is welcome, because then it's only putting things into place, or it's only formalizing what should come underway anyways. I don't know if Amy, you had any concluding remarks in that respect.
So I think that this is an unusual moment in which we have a lot of technology and a lot of information that we're not yet in a position to utilize, but it exists. For example, if you're in a factory and it's got any level of structure, you're going to see an RFID tag on it, which indicates what it is, where it came from, where it's going. You cannot run modern manufacturing, you cannot run modern office functions without having traceability. And really, in the last 20 years, that has changed dramatically. And it's going to enable not just the employer, but the employer and the employee to make better decisions, because they're not going to lose things. They're not going to send the wrong things to the wrong places. It's just a very different context, but it requires additional education. It requires rewards for education, and it also requires trust. Employers have to trust employees, and employees have to feel valued, and they have to feel that they're trusted. And, you know, at different moments in the history of the world, we've had more and less of those set of feelings. But at this point, since we're increasingly being an integrated globe, we have to be capable of accounting and utilizing the tools that exist. And I think that employers themselves, if you've ever talked to an employer that's had a disaster on site, somebody cut their finger off or something blew up in a process, they don't feel good about that. It doesn't make them feel good. It's a terrible experience. And those are the kinds of things that are our responsibility to utilize the technology to actually eliminate those experiences. And all of that is about trust, education, and active participation.
Thank you. Farid?
Hi. It's again the Amy's viewpoints. I would just add that I think this topic is important in view of the feeling that too many workers at risk of not making a living wage face this feeling that globalization does not work for them. The feeling that through globalization, workforce can be cheaper elsewhere, meaning that as a response, basically there can be multiple responses to that. But fundamentally, I think this discussion and the concept of living wage is a very practical, concrete, targeted way to work on the question of inequalities. At the benefits fundamentally of employers as much as of policymakers somehow, because ultimately this topic is really at the core of why you don't go to a factory or wherever to operate in poor conditions. You need to make fundamentally a living that helps face, you know, your day-to-day costs. It's very, very, very important discussion. I'm just wondering why there are not more companies working on that. I mean, Amy, what's your view on that? What would be, in your opinion, for what you can see in the US, the penetration of the concept of living wage across, let's say, employers or companies that are conducting their own kind of homework in the space? It's like more like 5%, 10%? Well, surprise me and tell me that it's significantly more, and I'd be just happy to hear that. So
what I can say is that who I talk to investment organizations, I talk to individual employers, I talk to leaders in NGOs and various different types of organizations. And I will say that despite the fact that there is a sort of skepticism in some people's minds about socially responsible development, you actually find that the people inside the organization, they're trying to, this is like a new day for them. They all of a sudden feel like they can do well by doing good. And some employers, they're never going to get it. And that is the history of the world. But I am surprised at the number of organizations and the repeat narrative that is in popular press and in the business press about the fact that it doesn't have to be done improperly. It can be done properly. We have the tools now. 100 years ago, you couldn't count very much. Today, you can count almost anything. And once you can count something, you create accountability. And then the question is, do we trust people to actually use that for good? And my experience so far seems to be that it's a really different day.
It's fair. It's true that, I've seen across some of our programs a lot of skepticism among employers, human resources, and payroll people at the beginning with this type of project. But as soon as they understand the concept, they see some of the gaps. They start to look at their position and the levers that they can have with their own job very differently. And Generally speaking, I would say, not to say all the time, of course, there can be exceptions, but as a rule of thumb, there is this kind of journey where professionals in that space move from, not all of them, some embrace the project from the beginning, but there is some skepticism at the beginning, to a situation where there is strong alignment across that kind of community to say, well, let's work on it, let's do something. It's not necessarily a big cost, but there are huge benefits coming out of that. It's definitely the journey in which those kind of professionals are whenever they start working on living wage. For policymakers, I don't know.
Policymakers are actually more skeptical, I think, and because it makes them have to work harder and they have to make compromises that they haven't had to make before. And quite frankly, it's not clear to us whether or not they actually understand what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So we have an education responsibility on their end. I know that I get calls from congressional leaders from their staff, and they ask questions like, what do we do? How do we do it? Who's doing it? Why are they doing it? Even at all the way up to the Congress, and whether or not the Congress actually pays people fairly. And so people are not being just silent anymore. They're actually are stepping up and saying, well, you know, if I don't try, I'll never know.
Yeah, no, that's interesting because, an argument that I've heard from policymakers has been that ultimately they are benchmarked, their location, geographies or whatever is benchmarked by international investors or foreign investment. And in those kind of type of benchmark schemes, they fear that increasing cost of workforce ultimately make their territory, country, whatever your county or anything, less attractive. Therefore, sometimes it's better at least to keep, for example, to not update minimum wages for decades, to remain fairly attractive. And that's the type of mindset I think that is completely wrong, because there is always, if you start playing that game, there is always another location that can be cheaper than you. So that's, I don't think that's the right approach, but still, I can see that that's something that we can hear as a concern that is expressed. So any argument welcome, Amy, about that.
So I actually, one of the things that's interesting is to look at higher education. I mean, as an academic, I do that on a regular basis. And I will say that in some respects, we're a little bit behind. I think that we've struggled for a long time and we've seen very little progress. And so seeing progress, we're skeptical about it. But I actually think that it isn't that we have to get to 50%. It is that we have to get to, I think, 30%. And when we get to 30%, there is just, it's everybody's creeping over, moving toward a better outcome. And we're in a moment of great flux. And honestly, the economy globally is actually helping out, right? We're not in a recession right now. We see that growth is occurring in places that have been pretty stagnant. And so, you know, it's a propitious time to actually try and experiment and to not feel that what you have to say doesn't count. Because I think that actually from an employee perspective, it does count. You know, we've made a lot of effort to take on big issues and they're starting to pay off.
Amy, would you direct some of our participants to particular research or courses that can help people navigate the concept and understand some of the, I would say, the benefits?
Well, one of the things that we talk about in the Institute is the extent to which we try to essentially take apart what we now treat as a whole wage and actually define it more precisely. and to create a recognition that in some cases, when you have a quote unquote benefits loaded salary or wage, you actually are not taking into account the fact that what you're offering may actually not cover the cost of that particular part of somebody's life. And so when employers are trying to figure out how they adjust what they're doing over time, really thinking through what's the composition of your benefits. I mean, institutions change benefits programs readily depending upon the price. One of the things that we don't often think about is the fact that in a number of cases, benefits are actually oligopolistic and sometimes almost monopolistic. So it's not about price as a competitive presence. It is actually what somebody can basically get away with. And I think that there are a lot of examples where thinking creatively and being more discerning about what it is that you think is important, talking to your employees, being aware of the kinds of experiences that they have, recognizing the variability of things like inflation. In the United States, over the last 24 months, we've had just radical departures of the inflationary effects, the sort of lag effects of COVID and then the recovery of the economy. And it has had tremendously negative impacts on people's, how far their salary goes, right? The salary isn't changing as fast as the inflation is affecting the costs. So I think that there's a lot that can be, we can benefit significantly from having access to good information and paying attention to it.
Thank you. I guess with that, we can maybe conclude. Farid, maybe you want to share the last slide just to tell participants and everybody that they can find a lot of blog articles and things we've written around living wage. Of course, they can reach out also to the Living Institute website for more information about the work that Amy talked about. We have another upcoming webinar as well with the OECD, Forum next week, not on living wage, but on forced labor in the green transition. So also join us next time on this topic. Thank you for taking the time today. Thank you for the speakers, for your insights. And yeah, have a lovely morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever you are. Thank you very much.
Maybe, Amy, we can share a closing word as people are not all leaving. Any closing word?
So what I would say is it's really wonderful to be here. It is so exciting to think that halfway around the world, 8 hours away from where I am here, that this conversation is taking place. You and I have been in the business of this topic for about 20 years each, and it's a lonely road that we originally traveled, but it's not a lonely road anymore. There's a lot of people that are thinking about this, and it's I really feel that, I mean, one of the things that we set the Living Wage Institute up for was I couldn't handle the amount of traffic. There was just so many people with so many different questions. And it just made sense. It made sense to start standardizing things. It made sense to make tools that other people could use. It made sense to actually call your congressman and tell them what you think. And so I think that this has been an exciting discussion, and I really look forward to the kinds of analysis that you were putting up with your slides, because it is possible to do this now, and we should take advantage of that, and we should try to, you know, share little things we learn about, you know, complexities in one location versus sort of the ease of implementing in another location, and also recognizing that you know, half the time I get people who call me and they already have done their calculations. Canada is a good example. They have highly localized living wage calculations, and they have little regional networks of people that are basically pushing wage rates up. And so I think this is an opportune time to have a conversation like this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I think we can leave the conversation here, and Amy, I'm sure that we'll be in touch with high pleasure.
Well, enjoy the Olympics. All right. Well, thank you. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.